Hi there. I want to thank Professor Viewers for another lively and sparkling paper. I'm probably going to give the impression tonight, the impression I gave Monday and probably will give on Friday, that I mostly disagree. And that is indeed the case. But I'm not, I don't have enough time to talk about what I like about what he's doing and wish I did. So it's more interesting to disagree in circumstances like this. But I just wanted to make note of my inability and failure to say something of the about the things that I like and what he's trying to do. So, in my first response to Professor Gururi's first lecture, I concentrated on his conception of critique and the irresolvable skeptical dilemmas which cripple such a conception both in theory and practice. I referred to this conception as belonging to an unmasking model of critique which has been dominant in the humanities at least since the 1980s, the practice of which, as I said, requires that anything and everything be subject to, be the potential object of, unmasking. Critique, in other words, practiced as relentless dismantling, as ruthless interrogation. And my point was, and it's not mine alone, that once this model of critique makes itself an object of unmasking, it becomes riddled with skeptical paradoxes of self-reference, which are symptoms of logical and epistemological incoherence that reveal the extent to which critique in this sense has turned into a degenerating paradigm of critical inquiry. The term degenerating paradigm was introduced by the philosopher of science Imre Lakatos to explain what happens when a paradigm of inquiry is overwhelmed by anomalies that cannot be explained and dissolved from within the resources of that paradigm. So, thinking of it as a degenerating paradigm would provide a different explanation of the crisis in literary theory that Professor Gururi discussed in his first lecture, I think would be apposite. In any case, critique need not be construed only as a practice of unmasking. It's not our only possibility, and I have proposed what I think is a more attractive alternative in my book, Critique and Disclosure. I'm still developing that alternative, and a new book that will be published by Columbia next year will present its latest iteration. Now, in addition to reworking the idea of secular criticism, Gururi's also introduced us to his vision of the tragic life, which is expanded and amplified in this second lecture and set in opposition to post-secular accommodations of religious outlooks and claims, though primarily in opposition to the metaphysics of Judeo-Christian monotheism. Although in discussion he indicated he doesn't like the language of the good and of hypergoods, despite being of Greek provenance, his tragic vision of life fits the definition of a hypergood without remainder. The vision of the tragic life he offers is not just a vision of the good life, the most worthy life for human beings. It is also used as a standard or standpoint for assessing competing visions of the good life, in this case, those that are open to the idea of transcendence, whether of a religious or non-religious kind. When a vision of the good life is used argumentatively as the basis for assessing other visions of the good life, as Gururi does in his lectures, it turns into a hypergood. As Charles Taylor shows in his book, Sources of the Self, a vision of the good becomes a hypergood when it is construed as, quote, incomparably more important than others and at the same time provides the standpoint from which other goods must be weighed, judged, decided about, close quote. Thus, Gururi bases his atheism on a tragic view of life which is presented as superior to religious faith and transcendental reason and defended against both morality and rationality. To this hypergood, Gururi ascribes the following properties: being prepared to live without a guarantee of meaning, in a state of permanent disbelief and radical uncertainty, open to wonder and the wondrous, and open to the risk and indeed danger of making decisions and judgments without any normative or ontological guarantees. Sounds exciting. And also rather familiar, since the vision offered here, with or without appeal to the tragic, is comprised of staple figures of post-structuralist thought since its emergence in the late 1960s. These properties are presumed to be wholly absent by definition in the rival views of the good Grigoris names religious faith and transcendental reason. Unfortunately, Grigoris' characterization of these goods is either one-dimensional or caricatured. Whatever one may think of the Christian faith, it does not reduce to or is best exemplified by American right-wing evangelicals. Martin Luther King and Bishop Romero would be more difficult cases to parody than Antonin Scalia. I am by no means, no surprise, persuaded by the account of the secular or secularism offered by Professor Grigoris. It strikes me as sociologically thin and conceptually undercomplex. The concepts of the secular, of secularism, and secularization are related, but they are also distinct concepts, the meaning of each of which is itself highly contested and indeed unavoidably contestable and contextual. Nonetheless, in the ongoing present debates on secularity, secularism, and secularization, they have been developed by a number of theorists and social scientists to a level of complexity and nuance that is missing from Professor Grigoris' application of them. Moreover, something is at stake in these debates that is also absent from Professor Grigoris' account, and that is the question which underlies and drives these debates to begin with. How are we going to live together? Under what shared understanding of what that would mean when we live in a world of many rival ethical conceptions, a world of deep diversity? Grigoris does not even pose the question, and it is the question, for it is not the case that human plurality is ever going to disappear. The secularism debates have reminded us, once again, of the multiplicity and resiliency of deeply diverse and rival ethical and religious visions, of deeply diverse and rival ways of living and being. As attractive as Grigoris finds the tragic view of life, it is not the only one to which human beings have been drawn or will be drawn. It is but one of many, and those who are drawn to other conceptions will have compelling reasons of their own as to why they prefer theirs to his or to any of the others. How do we speak to, live with, those with whom we profoundly disagree? That's our question. The question of how are we going to live together is thus a normative question, a type of question Grigoris prefers to avoid, but pose it he must if he does not wish to have his view of the tragic life dismissed as just one more sectarian view out there. So it is not enough, I think, to engage in these debates in polemical fashion. The atheism he espouses sounds to me like a version of negative freedom, responding to the resurgence of religion in the public sphere as a threat to that kind of freedom. Put colloquially, just get out of my face, man. I want to do my own thing here. But perhaps, underline perhaps, exclamation, I've gotten Professor Grigoris completely wrong. And what I've revealed here are not the limitations of his thinking, but of my own. So I would like to conclude with a series of questions that might help dispel any possible confusion. 1. Professor Grigoris claims that the tragic view of life, his tragic view of life, is against rationality. But he offers arguments which must meet minimal standards of intelligibility and rationality, which is simply to say that they must be capable of rational persuasion of some kind. 2. He claims, moreover, that his tragic view of life is against morality, But he also claims that we must be concerned, must show compassion, must care for what is human. To my ear, these three musts sound like they are moral musts, moral obligations of some kind. But why must we? How do we answer this question of why without some normative justification? 3. He claims to be committed to a model of critique for which everything is in principle subject to relentless dismantling and interrogation. But it seems to me that some things are exempt, off limits, untouchable. For example, the tragic view of life he espouses and his brand of atheism, which he described as undeconstructible. Why? Why are they exempt from relentless dismantling and interrogation, and secularism and religion are not? In fact, why is this very model of critique not exempt from interrogation? Shouldn't we interrogate the idea of critique as interrogation? Do we really want critique to be aligned with the practice of torture? 4. Professor Grigouris claims to reject any appeal to transcendence of any kind, but openness to wonder and to the wondrous sounds like an appeal to transcendence to me, to what lifts us out of our normal routines and experience. There's just 2 more. 5. He claims to reject certainty, but seems at the same time very certain that the tragic view of life is superior to other views of the good. I'm wondering, did he really decide to believe in the tragic on the basis of evidence and reasons, or was he drawn to it as we are drawn to a good? 6, and finally, he claims to prefer discomfort to comfort, but never steps out of the comfort zone of his own convictions and his preferred theoretical vocabulary to engage in the risk-filled attempt of making sense of the convictions of the other, of others, in her or in their own terms, not his. I don't expect Professor Grigouris to answer all these questions. There are others here who have their own questions, probably better than these, and I'll just be satisfied if he answers just the one. Thank you.
Does this work? Okay, it does. Well, you're right.
Before we start, just let me make clear, no other person in the room will be allowed to ask six questions.
But I will answer all 6 questions. If only briefly, of course, because then we would definitely take up our entire time. I mean, some of the questions are unfair. I will actually point that out. But the first one is in some ways a kind of a misplaced question because the fact that I'm arguing for a poetic encounter with the world does not mean that I am acting irrationally. That I am engaged in a rational argument because we are in a context of that kind of conversation, which is that is to say, this is the performative instance that to which I of course I have agreed to participate. Hence, I'm conducting a rational argument. I could have written a poem or could have played music. That would not be the proper performative way of engaging. So that is not it's not a question that I think pertains to the crux of the matter. The second question, the question about musts, is a very important question, and it's one that I'm often, of course, asked. How can you speak about the lack of norms or the lack of guarantee, normative guarantee, and then proceed, in fact, to take positions. And I do think it's the hardest question of all. I mean, I tried to talk about it a bit last time, and I talked about a certain kind of acrobatic way of encountering the world and where one has to make decisions. I'm a skeptic who makes decisions, as I said several times, and therefore when one makes decisions, one is, in fact, creating norms of some kind, which one then presumably follows if one does not want to be considered being consistent. Nowhere, though, do I prescribe these norms to anyone else. I mean, I consider them to be they're decisive for me in this particular engagement. This is definitely a polemical piece. This we have to acknowledge, right? The fact that it's a polemical piece does not mean that I'm excluding the opposition. In fact, on the contrary, I must say I've been the object of extreme polemics on the part of those who claimed to be in favor of the equality of all positions and truths, which is a terribly liberal position, a very, very problematic liberal position that actually presumes that critique is neutral and objective, while in fact all critique is always agonistic, always partial, and in that sense always polemical. So, but yes, I do acknowledge the problem. The problem is the problem occurs when one steps into the realm of decision, and where in fact then some sort of normative structure is produced as a result of that. But as I argued last time, if in fact one's sense of the context of decision and in fact the whole context of argument, or not just argument, but coexistence, is provisional, meaning it must always be put to interrogation, then those norms do not achieve some kind of transcendental position that enables them to exist outside of my decision or the context. So that is definitely something we can talk a great deal about. The third question is also not fair in the sense that I've been saying it constantly. That critique is always self-critique and self-interrogative. So I never suggest that anything that I said here is dogmatic. I mean, I would not. I mean, that's the whole point of being in front of an audience. I expect that I would be questioned for what I'm saying, and that if I falter in not being adequately critical with some of the positions I have taken, this is certainly, first of all, my responsibility, and second, I would welcome anyone to come and say, "Whoa, you know, that is not something that you're being critical, self-critical about." So nowhere am I suggesting that the critical position, the one I'm arguing, atheist or whatever, is beyond question. On the contrary, in fact, I'm always talking about how provisional it is and how open to question. This leads to the fourth point about transcendence and openness to the other. This is a point of contention, obviously. My argument about being open to the other is precisely so as to avoid the domination of a transcendent position. In order really to be, because the moment that a position exists outside and has authority in itself, then that otherness, in fact, cannot be encountered. One can only submit to it. The only way that you can really encounter another is as an equal, as an other one of you. Not like you, of course, because that is another. But it cannot be someone who has power over you by some sort of by dictum. All transcendental positions presuppose that kind of authority, external authority. Now, I said also that immanent positions, meaning positions that don't claim to be self-sufficient entirely, can also run into the same problem. So in fact, the difficult, again, in other acrobatics would be that we don't just simply take a position in favor of transcendence or in favor of immanence, etc., but in fact try to break down that kind of differentiation between them. That's a more difficult philosophical point that we can discuss. The fifth point about the superiority of the tragic. I mean, I can see how one can come out with that impression that I'm arguing for the tragic as superior. I'm not arguing for it as something superior. I take it to be a way that one can live one's life freely. Of course, it's my decision to do that, to engage that kind of mode of freedom as opposed to the freedom of law or principles or some kind of system that guarantees it. It's an option. It's not by any means superior to any other. Of course, in the polemics of an argument, where one is really obviously arguing against and trying to take apart some other position, There is the presumption that what you're defending is the good, what, you know, and the enemy is bad. Yes, I mean, in a kind of very elementary sense. But that is really performative. There's nowhere in the argument that I am saying that a tragic existence is superior, let's say, to a moral existence, or superior to a materialist existence, or whatever that would be, you know, the love of money. The sixth one, I think, is also a kind of misquestioned thing about the comfort zone. I don't think that. I think that, you know, I told you when I started before this that this is a very unusual paper for me to write. Obviously, I'm there's a lot at stake. I'm using the first person a great deal. I'm really taking a great deal of risk in order to be accused of all the things that I'm being accused. So it's hardly the thing to say that I'm actually in a comfort zone. On the contrary, I think that in a way, this is a sort of, uncomfortable, discomforting position. And it produces a sense of discomfort. I think that I expect that. So I don't consider that to be the first and the sixth question are false questions. The other four are, most of them are important, and I hope that gave some sense. And certainly I did not do justice to the questions. I mean, that goes without saying. It's too brief of a response. But thank you, really appreciate it.
I'm not sure whether Professor Comprivi. Well, maybe someone else from the audience.
One of these mics.
Okay. Thanks for the lecture and for the response. I just want to ask a question. Would you think that organized religion is to religion as organized atheism is to atheism?
I'm not sure what is organized atheism really. I mean there are these websites, you know, the Atheists Unite kind of things. I don't know what there is really. Right. So, right. I mean, I'm utterly ignorant of it. I mean, so that's a good question. I'm clearly ignorant of it, and I have not thought of it that way at all. You understand that was my argument against that kind of, dogmatic atheism that is organized in the sense that it, particularly to the degree that it might seek converts. So that would be, that's total anathema to me. And in that respect, that goes for any kind of organized ideological group that seeks converts, okay? So religious practice is not necessarily that. There's a great deal of religious practice that is, in fact, very respectful of people around, people of other beliefs or non-beliefs. But, you know, it's the religious practice that isn't that that is of concern to me. The one that tries to establish a realm that everyone must follow. And that is rampant in the world today. No particular religion is privy to it. I mean, every one of them, well, not almost every one of them, it's a good, very big discussion, but most of them involve at some point or another the demand for conversion or a sense of superiority. So yes, if strictly speaking, it would be the same, yes. That's not the atheism I'm espousing. I mean, I hope that's clear.
I think there was another question there, John.
Yeah. So I want to understand why you give the tragic a positive story at all. Like when you were saying that, I could almost hear Nick saying this is a conception of the good. I mean, it just seems that your only explanation for why you give it a positive story is about you, about your life. Where you come from, it seems like someone could undertake that mode of practice and not have a very rewarding life at all. Quite a miserable life. But that doesn't undermine the project that you're on necessarily.
Yes, I mean, I don't. I've written a lot about tragedy. I mean, in previous writings, specifically about actual tragedies and the phenomenon of tragedy in the ancient world and so on and so forth. And I am interested, obviously, in a certain kind of tragic philosophy. So in this paper, this is very, very scant and not really fully developed. But people who would be familiar with my writing would know what I mean. I certainly do not mean what I meant, this sends us back to Monday, that there's something heroic about tragedy. In fact, I completely divest the heroic from the tragic. I know that this is not a very orthodox reading of tragedy, right? Tragic hero and so on and so forth. And that is because for me, the tragic mode of existence really is, if it's going to be said simply, is existing without any guarantee. Really, it's kind of, that would be the bottom line, and we can say other things about it. And that requires a very different relation to time and to the other, and to, you know, how one relates to other people and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that it is a happy existence at all. Nor am I saying it's a miserable existence. In fact, you know, all I'm saying is that in the midst of the greatest happiness, a tragic engagement with the world would have to be one in which even the moment of greatest happiness could easily be a moment of unraveling. One cannot, in fact, assume any guarantee. And that is a very difficult way to live. I'm not even presuming to say that I personally live that way. To tell you the truth, I think it's very, very difficult. I mean, it is really something that I aspire and I come back to often. But to speak about myself is kind of silly here. I'm not, you know, this is not some kind of confession situation. It's really not something I'm prescribing. I find the lack of guarantee a freeing thing. So there's that. Not a happy thing.
Just the difficulty in articulating it, but you use terms like freeing, openness. I mean, these are all positive. Right. They carry baggage with them, you know.
Inevitably, yes. But what are we going to do? I mean, we have to use language. I mean, I'm in favor of democracy. People are telling me, my God, in democracy, look what's happening in the name of democracy. So what? I mean, you know, the point is to make sure to go against all those horrible things that happen in the name of democracy. I opt for democracy as opposed to something else, you know, for very specific reasons and so on. The fact that we use words with baggage, I mean, what can we do? I mean, we have to deal with the baggage, but we can't simply not use them because they have baggage. Or assume that because they have baggage, always, they will mean always that. It's our responsibility to you know, clarify that as much as possible.
There was a question here.
Somebody writing in the field of ethnic conflict most of my life.
Right. It's on. I think it's on. It's on.
Secular and non-secular. Practical context. For example, I've been recently involved in the Northern Ireland, now in the Middle East. And these are real problems. There are moments when an agreement could have been made.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtleties that you've raised tonight in the theoretical discussion would have been enormously valuable, and a lot of the critique would not have been there
mm-hmm.
if you'd related the concepts to, you'd applied them to real situations, and you had the sort of tantalizing references to the other, mm-hmm. to tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be, for example, the most extreme person in saying, I just don't like Jews, I don't like Arabs, and so on. But in a context, for example, if you saw the film A Separation, this says an enormous amount about the flexibility, the of those concepts in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the conceptual problems would be clarified and in many cases eliminated if you gave reference to the subtle circumstances that are the characteristic of the modern world. Nothing is more important
mm-hmm.
than to understand the difference between, I've loved your reference to authority, the authority of the transcendental. And that's a danger.
Mm-hmm.
And so you make a distinction when you talk about the Muslim faith as to what it's, how it plays itself out in different contexts of greater or lesser tolerance of the other. And I think to talk about that in terms of the other, the tolerance of the other in structural terms and also in terms of the power of the arts to move the human spirit to have greater empathy. Sometimes that empathy, which might be natural, is prevented because the structures of authority favour one cast of mind rather than another.
No, I understand very well what you're saying. I mean, that's the nature of this text is such that takes the risk of a certain decontextualization, and that's deliberate, and it succeeds or fails on that basis of this as a strategy. That's not generally true of everything I write, and I certainly it depends on the context and the kind of stakes. Every piece of writing, I don't feel that I have to engage with specific examples of the real world in every single thing I write. Okay, when I wrote last year when it was about the Egypt uprising, and when I write also journalism, and I'm very interested in that, so it was a whole different kind of writing. I spoke very specifically in what sense I'm not an expert in the Middle East, okay, but in the context, I'm generally interested though in the assembly movements and in radical democratic action of the last 2 years or so all around. So the Egypt thing became part of my general interest in that. But I argued that this was precisely a secular event. Why? This has nothing to do with the fact that very devout Muslims were participating. There's no doubt about that. That, in fact, I pointed it out. In order precisely to show that the coexistence or the kind of coincidence of action between this incredible range of people, of constituencies of action, from radical workers who had been conducting strikes for years and of course being killed, you know, repeatedly, they were crucial to this event, to various groups of women, again, women who were either devout Muslims or women who were entirely non-practicing and perhaps might even be called secular, to students who were involved, to people who used the internet, all those kinds of things that we heard, to the Muslim Brotherhood. The kind of coincidence of these constituencies in a public space, in the way that it was conducted, is the perfect example of what would be a secular event. And it was very interesting that I was attacked by various, some of them are friends, because I used allegedly a Western categorization. And I found that to be preposterous. I will tell you why. Because, first of all, it says that the secular, it belongs to the West. That's the most Orientalist thing that one can say. It means it's as if, people who are not Western cannot be secular. That's absurd. The word secular, the secular includes the devout. It's not. It doesn't exclude the devout. It just simply understands the devout as one of the many practices in a society, and it presumably, and that's a very very big presumably, and has to do with all kinds of legal structures, etc. Presumably protects society from any constituency establishing its own dogma over the other, okay? But I underline the presumably, okay? I understand that this, France is a great example of of the big mess of what that is. So I take your point very seriously, but it isn't. It is really the nature of this particular. Please, at least indulge me in that. That it's the nature of this particular piece of writing that is not a practice. I would just say generally say, well, don't make connections to the real or to the actual events or to areas of conflict. No. Obviously, I agree with you entirely. Yes, but this piece is sort of suspended in the midst of a whole bunch of others, including the three lectures and other things that I'm writing, and I'm, you know, sort of... Well, thank you, but it's like a piece of music, you know, it's in a sense there is a certain kind of attitude in a particular piece of music that would lack certain things that one might say, well, this piece is terribly dissonant, and it doesn't... It does not resolve at all, and it sounds like a fragment. Yes, it might be in and of itself, but in a particular suite, there may be. You know what I'm saying? But thank you. I appreciate your point.
I think there was another question there somewhere.
This poetic enterprise, this, you know, the gambler's stance and this practice of improvisation, staring down the abyss, this is not necessarily an argument against God or spiritual. In fact, it's perhaps a very God-like way of being, because maybe the universe is a poem, you know, I notice you have avoided spirit because it's troublesome, I think. But you've excluded it from your argument.
Yes, that's a very good point. I have. I'm trying to think whether. I mean, it's not a term spirit in the particular in the Western tradition is very problematic. So I do avoid it. Now I'm thinking quickly. Generally speaking, I avoid it. It's not impossible. It's not possible to entirely avoid it. But here it wasn't, it's a very good point you're making in the sense that I'm not arguing against the spiritual, I'm not excluding the spiritual, but certainly it's not the language that I want to use. And we can debate that, why maybe there is an inadequacy not using it and so on. I don't know. But yes, from a certain, the other thing you said, encountering the abyss is the quit. That's what religion is about. You know, I mean, in any kind of, this is a kind of psychoanthropological explanation for why human societies have developed religion. And this, it's arguable too. But in any case, it's a classic thing to say. It's encountering the abyss, the fact that things are utterly uncertain, and the fact that death is impossible to overcome. I mean, this is kind of an elementary point. So yes, from a certain standpoint, one might say that my argument of encountering the abyss is really the kind of language, poetic as you mentioned. It's a kind of poetic language that belongs and certainly is very much part of all kinds of religious traditions, at least in their texts and even in their practices, mystical practices and so on. The only difference would be in the sense that and God, you know, the way I'm using it here, I'm working very much within a monotheistic framework, particularly Christian. That too is a strategy. It's deliberate that I stayed within that. I'm not actually speaking about people's experience of what they would call God, okay? And there's all kinds of experiences, you know, the varieties of religious experience, right? I'm speaking about an authoritarian position that can be called God that is posited to be outside our life, our daily life. And this doesn't have to be God. It could be the state. It could be a reason. Very important to understand that my critique would extend to those as well in the same way. Huh? At that particular point, then religious experience or religious practices lapse, and what takes their place is actually an occluding of the abyss. It's what actually Chayit keeps you from having that encounter, because you've got a guarantee. You get a text that says sacred book that has it all. It says it all, and you can just simply follow the commands. Or you have a particular priest or a cleric who'll do it for you, as it were, who takes it upon himself or herself to do it, or whatever it might be. Huh? And at that point, I definitely differentiate myself from it.
The fact that you use the word poem, perhaps a poem is the living part of language, the most alive part of language. So perhaps the human being is the most alive part of what is possible. So perhaps we have to revisit, you know, what God is, because God's a poet, maybe, you know, maybe the human being is the most evolved, the most growing. I would prefer
to say, if we're going to use that language, that not that God is a poet, but that God is a poem. Right? I mean, that's to say what human
beings... Oh, it's a verb.
Yes, but it's a poem. I mean, to use, you know...
I think my question may have been answered by this discussion a second ago, but you've talked before about you living a life without guarantees. Could you just explicate on that by mentioning examples of what you consider to be guarantees, unless it is answered by, for instance, believing in having a religious belief? I mean, does it go as mundanely as, say, the guarantee of the affection of your family, which you may experience, or the security of a job, or the guarantee of whatever? What is a life with guarantees unless...
Yes, I mean, first of all, I mean, certainly there's no guarantee to the security of one's job, certainly not in this world. except for tenured professors, maybe. No, of course, I'm kidding. I'm completely kidding. But, no, I think my argument would be that even the love and devotion of your loved ones is not a guarantee. I mean, in a kind of dogmatic sense. I mean, it is really something that you engage with and that you hope for. Because how could you live without hoping for that? It's very, very, very hard, I mean. But you cannot really ever, in a kind of, at the last instance, have that as a guarantee. Because the moment you do that, in some ways, you take away from your family and your loved ones their capacity to love you. You basically codify it. It becomes formulaic. You know, they're there for me, and so, you know, then that sort of thing. But let's make it a really hard case and say, you know, law, of course, that's the hardest one of all. Can we, you know, what does it mean to think about living without guarantee in a condition of law? And here, you know, I mean, I've written and I teach a great deal about anarchy, okay? I'm not against institutions of law, but I'm certainly against the institution of law as a disembodied authority, as something that exists and therefore it must be obeyed. That it exists because it must exist because there's never been a society without law. And even if there were to be the case that there's never been a society without law, we have to understand that all laws are made by human beings, by men and women, and that for this reason, there's nothing just or unjust about them in that sense. I mean, there are attempts to create justice, and oftentimes produces terrible injustice in the name of law. So, you know, a relationship to law, or from the standpoint that I'm mentioning, would be one where not just simply that all law is subject to question, which is the right of every citizen in a democratic polis, it's the duty of every citizen, but even the question of where does law come from or who authorizes law must always be under question. So that there's no way that we can settle in comfort zone over the fact that law exists and we're covered, because in the end we'd be protected and so on and so forth. Now that's nothing to do with religion. I'm using that example to give you a sense of what I mean. Yes, I mean.
That's guaranteed.
I am. That's a guarantee. That's a sophisticated response. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the concept of law is a guarantee. In societies that have raised law to the ultimate safeguard. But that's a problem because oftentimes that concept takes over the substance, the contentious terrain of the law. Right? Thank you.
Is there another question there?
Just to take the point further, then. I'm sorry to...
quite all right. Let's go at it. That's great.
You said you live without guarantees, right? And you said, I think, that you live a very difficult life by living without guarantees. Does that entail that those people who fear they don't live a particularly difficult life in that sort of sense are creating artificial guarantees? Is that what you aim?
Well, all guarantees are artificial. That's my argument. Meaning they're created by human beings. I mean, I'm not saying to say that
well, delusionary guarantees. Perhaps, right? Perhaps I should use the word instead of artificial, delusionary guarantees.
Yes, I used the word delusion twice or maybe three times, and I realized it's a very strong word to use. If we're going to not be moralistic about it, right, and to say that there's some truth that we have to overcome, that would overcome delusion. Yes, I mean, in the sense that it would be a misperception to think that you are covered, you have a safeguard, a transcendental safeguard, when you in fact don't. And that, only in that strict sense would we call it delusionary, not delusional. We don't want to go into a pathology. It's not a pathology issue. Okay. But all guarantees are artificial. That's the whole point. When I'm saying that living life without guarantees, I'm not saying that no guarantees are ever put into effect, because they have to be. This is back to the discussion about norms, but that they have to be understood to have been put there by us, not by some other entity. And that they are provisional, meaning that just because we put them there doesn't mean also that we're done. Now we can go home. We created our guarantees and then we're done. Because then they become actually, they go to an elsewhere.
I was wondering, you may know the
joke. Right, yes. Well, that's for sure. that is, of course, and that would go back to the taxation in the sense that, of course, there is a society and we don't live in the jungle. But, because taxation really is about as archaic as anything. But that will go back to the question about the tragic. There is, in this business, one limit that is really an insurmountable limit, and that is death. I mean, that's the kind of thing that the tragic imagination that produced, you know, a certain kind of attitude towards the world and a certain kind of art, takes to be the point of departure. That in the classic, the second ode in Antigone, which is really a wonderful text, incredible poetic text about the human being, and Sophocles there says that the human being, anthropos is the word, so it's not man, okay, it's really translated man, but it should not be gendered. It's really, in Greek, it's really the human being. The human being is the most horrifying, the most capacious and horrifying being in the universe, more even than the gods. There is no limit as to what the human being can do. Absolutely no limit. It can do, and then there's, of course, a list of things, you know, except for one thing that is a limit that is, in fact, something that a human being does not control, and that is death. So the whole issue here is, what do you do with a limitlessness while you're living? Because there is a limit that we all know is unavoidable. And that's my argument, is the more you understand the unavoidability of that limit, then you gain more responsibility and the stakes are raised even higher about the limitlessness within that limit, which is your life. And so, it's very difficult to live in the limitlessness, even well knowing that at some point it will end that you'll be arrested. You know what I mean? So we create limits all the time, and that's what society is. It's limits. So the question there is not just that we don't create limits, but that we think about what these limits are. The fact that we create them and not something else. And, you know, so on and so forth. Then we become politically invested in them, which means we're accountable for them and so on and so forth.
I was wondering whether I can ask a question, too, about the term atheist. In many respects, it's a reformulation of the previous comment that it's impossible. The two things that are impossible to avoid are death and taxation, because another way of phrasing that is that it's impossible on the one hand to not to think of ourselves in terms of existence and in terms of some kind of relation to the law. But I would like to ask a question about atheism returning to the great atheist of the Western tradition, namely Baruch Spinoza. You defined your atheism as opposition to other forms of atheism in two ways. Well, on the one hand, precisely in terms of existence, you're not interested in the question about whether God exists or does not exist. Mm-hmm. Rather, you're interested in the way that this allows, the question of atheism allows for a way of thinking life. And therefore encountering our own mortality as a kind of limit that that allows us to in a sense make decisions and all these conditions of disbelief that you're talking about, overcoming basically the sort of the miracle of resurrection that holds together the whole structure of transcendence that you're referring to. Now, it seems to me that that's a very Spinozan thought in Ethics. Part 4, Proposition 72, he famously says, a very famous proposition of his book, The Ethics, the free man is the man who thinks of death least of all. Therefore, in a sense, if there is an ethical imperative for Spinoza, it's precisely the imperative to the imperative for living instead of a discourse that understands existence in terms of death. That's the first point. And the second point the second way that you define your atheism, which again seems to me very Spinozan, is in terms of the imperatives, in terms of the responsibilities that this condition of disbelief puts us in. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that was one of the points that Professor Comprivis kind of highlighted, all the musts. Mm-hmm. That come with adopting this kind of privileging of the importance of living, of understanding life in terms of living as opposed to a death. How all these musts, in a sense, can possibly be understood without recourse to normativity? Well, it seems to me that a norm, although this is the wrong word for many reasons, but a kind of point of decision already exists, and Spinoza talks about that, basically when we're faced in particular situations with a decision about going for life or going for death, we're absolutely entitled to make the decision to go for life. If you encounter a robber in the middle of the night, he says in chapter 16 of the Theological Political Treatise, and he threatens your life, you're entitled, he says, you have the natural right to be deceitful. You have the natural right to lie in order to save your life. This is not a norm in the sense that it imposes external criteria, because the criteria are always derived from the particular circumstances that you find yourself in. So anyway, so there is these two meanings then of atheist that we find in Spinoza, and it seems to me that your position is very similar. I was wondering whether
you know Spinoza better than me overall, but I think that I wouldn't. We've had this argument, or partly this argument before. I'm not sure whether I would say that Spinoza is an atheist. I mean, of course, from a certain standpoint, he is. But for him. I mean, yes, within the tradition of the Judaic tradition, he's an atheist. But he could also be called a pantheist. So that's a very kind of problematic coincidence, right? So I don't know whether so that I don't know if this is Spinoza in what I'm doing. I think that from a certain standpoint, the second part of your observation is definitely closer. Yes, one opts for life, but I would disagree with Spinoza that in fact it is the free. If we're going to use his language, the freest man is precisely the one who thinks about death without fear, but not the one who doesn't think about death, because it's only in thinking about death, that's the Spinoza is not a tragic thinker, actually. That would be another thing to say. Mm-hmm. But for me, that's the point in which we can opt for life. Because otherwise, what I want to avoid is some kind of a self-preservation principle. I mean, you opt for life out of just sheer self-preservation, which all animals have. I mean, although the human being is the most peculiar animal in regards to that, because it doesn't really have as good of an instinct for self-preservation as other animals. But let's say, okay, so that's the problem there with that phrase. I'm not sure I would agree with that phrase. But I agree with the second part, that that being so-called deceitful in situations where your life is threatened is in fact an essential response, but that's a matter of self-preservation. And it's not a norm. He's right. You're right. He doesn't say that's a norm. I'd have to think more about, and I have to develop more, at least in the discussion about miracles. Obviously, Spinoza has a lot to say that I have not included in this piece that I will definitely have to go into more.
Maybe time for one final question. Yeah.
I feel like just echoing a question or a point that was raised by your opposition here, and that was to do with how do we all live together? I mean,
yes,
philosophy and society was the headline or the central theme of this lecture series, and I felt that your presentation didn't quite answer or even address that question. I'm actually a bit surprised that you would posit a new form of atheism, an atheism beyond atheism, if you like, when the first form of atheism is already doing quite enough to perpetuate the conflicts and disagreements that are happening in the world with religions. And I'm probably not the only person in this room who's left scratching my head with this presentation of yours, because to me it seemed like an exercise in intellectualization, acrobatics with words, particularly big ones, and it ultimately didn't really give me any answers as to the big question.
Well, I'm sorry about that. That you didn't get the answers to big questions, but I disagree with you profoundly that atheism is the one that's producing havoc in this world. That's just not accurate. I mean, no. I mean, it's an important point to make. It's not accurate. I mean, I'm not saying that my God, it's very hard to even argue that the American imperialism is conducted on the basis of atheism. That's absurd. It's conducted on the basis of a certain kind of Christian and morality and a certain kind of investment in Christian superiority. There's nothing atheistic about American imperialism. We're going to take, the beast here as the object, okay? So automatically, that part of your question is compromised by that comment. Now, you're right, though, to bring up the and I'm glad you did, the issue about living together, because I forgot to address that. I'm very clearly against any liberal positions that are that espouse harmonious living together on some sort of equal basis, where everyone has some kind of guaranteed equal right to existence. Okay, because this is the principle in the name of which a great deal of destruction and subjugation of others has happened. Okay? Think about from what position can you, not you personally, okay, can anyone, where can one stand to make that kind of argument that we are, that we all must live together as if we are somehow inherently equal, where in fact we live in a world of extraordinary asymmetry of power and resources, where we live in a world of continuous conflict. It's a wonderful aspiration to imagine a world where there is no conflict. But frankly, there's never been a world without conflict in history. Okay? So the aspiration to be in a world without conflict is very nice and noble, but that's not the project. The project is to understand in what sense conflict does not produce greater domination. Okay? That does not produce greater asymmetry, or does not produce a kind of world where one power consistently dominates the other. It's a way of rethinking, you know, the problem of conflict. So the lectures are, yes, philosophy and society. It's true that there wasn't much discussion of society in this. This is very similar to the question that I was asked earlier. And it's true. Both of you are right. There is definitely philosophy that, and it's in some ways maybe too much philosophy, and not enough society. Although I'm talking always of politics, and you can say, well, I'm talking about politics in the abstract. Yes, insofar as we're having a kind of philosophical discussion, it is in the abstract. But as you notice in the discussion we're having here, I am very interested in the specifics of the world and in specific in society. I don't subscribe to ideologies of harmonious coexistence. I really, really find them terribly problematic. If you think that atheism is the one concept or one position that is primarily responsible for destroying the world, I think that the ideologies of so-called harmonious coexistence are the ones that are doing it, because they're terribly deceptive.
Can I just say, my point about atheism wasn't that atheism is the evil of the world. My point was that there's enough sex in the world already, S-E-C-T-S. So why do you feel the need to coin a new form of atheism that's in some way, somehow superior to what's already out there? And my second point, which I didn't quite get to before, was with the almost verbosity of this presentation, is philosophy really the best channel of trying to talk to the masses and to find solutions for the world when you have people who are clearly against or don't listen to the voice of reason and rationality and would... playing a piece of music might be more effective.
Yes, no, I understand, but I said that's not the context of playing. I mean, I'm interested in music. I'm poetry. I'm a poet and so on. This is not the context to play music or to read a poem, and it's not a context to talk to the masses. I mean, this is really not what we are in for. And when I write for I write often for Al Jazeera. I mean, I write about political events. That's a different language I'm using there. It's not a philosophical language, but it's not though a language entirely devoid of philosophical aspects, because it is important to learn to understand things a little bit beyond their particular narrow context. It's as much as the particular context is important, it's just as important to be able to think of the broader picture. So as far as the first thing is concerned, I'm not arguing for, I'm about a kind of a new organized atheism. I don't have that kind of project yet, where my kind of atheism, let's bring a whole bunch of other atheists and we can kind of do this thing. It's not really, I argued this way specifically to criticize the privilege of atheists let's say advocates of atheism. There are quite a few of them these days. I mentioned them, who are arguing on the basis of a certain kind of scientific, usually scientific truth and belief in rationality. You know, they're atheists because, you know, it's only reasonable, after all, that God, there's no such thing as God. I'm trying to distance myself from that kind of position, because that is a very problematic position, and it perpetuates a certain kind of Western domination of the kind that you're worried about, that I'm also worried about.
We have to stop here because we have to be out of here by 8 o'clock. I think your question is really excited, Professor Gurguri. So you'll have the first question on Friday if you care to come again.
Thank you very much,
Professor Gurguri, for the lecture.